This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every other Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Jen Hawk and Dr. Doug Lyle with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Good. Good. We're not quite as good as we would be if we had Jen with us.
And we just tell the listeners, we had some audio difficulties, and so the last podcast episode did not come out. We had some audio problems, but we are re-recording it, so we had to skip a week, not due to my own laziness this time, but yeah. It's just some audio technical difficulties. So this next one is the next one in series.
Yeah, we can go ahead and admit it. I screwed it up. And then Jen's brilliant work got thrown in the trash can. So we're hiding out from her doing this. And that's what we're doing. So that's how that works.
You know, it was a really good episode, Dr. Lau. You had some really good rants in there about confidence and confidence and consciousness. It was really great. So and attachment styles. So we'll look forward to it.
What we're going to do, folks, is we're going to answer the same questions that Jen and I answered in the recording that failed. Jen and I are going to do that all over again. And so these questions tonight are just questions that we haven't answered before. And so so we're not going to be leaving a bunch of brilliant Jen Hawk insight, you know, on the side of the road. We're going to resurrect what we did last time soon. All right.
Excellent. Well, let's just get straight to the questions. We don't need to do any small talk. So, dear Dr. Lyle,
thank God.
What would be the Stone Age benefit for women to seek only compassion and not direct help or solutions?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question, and it's the kind of question that what did you do when your mom caught you in the closet? Okay, it's assuming things that are not in evidence. So, what would be the Stone Age benefit for women seeking only compassion, not direct or helpful solutions? Well, who says that that's what Stone Age women did or that women do? Okay, so. It's cliche, a la Mars and Venus, that very often what women want is they want to, you know, process what their frustration, their problems, and a lot of times that will, you know, men are clicking their way through trying to solve it, and women are sometimes going to resist that because they've got a different agenda necessarily than the direct solution. There's maybe a wider social psychological process that's going on. But very often that is not true. So there is no evolved mechanism for this. In other words, everything that evolves, every characteristic that you observe psychologically or physically is going to be a genetically built adaptation. So so there may be differences in how women solve problems jointly through, and very often in relational problems of various kinds where they may process somewhat differently. The process may look a little differently than it might look when men are talking. Men are known to be more essentially, they think in terms of systems, women think in terms of people and interpersonal interaction. So there could be a somewhat occasionally different dynamic. Me personally, I have found it to be no problem of women coming to me with problems, asking me things, me listening, asking enough questions to feel like I understand it, and then giving them solutions. And they don't walk away like feel like they were shorthanded and I didn't allow them to process. That just doesn't happen. So, They have the same, when I get it right, they got the same look of relief and excitement, like, oh, thank God, now I understand. Right? So, I think sometimes it may be that somebody gives you a solution. The woman, you know, pitches her problem to her guy, and her guy gives a solution, and it's not good enough. And it's shortcutting something. It's not understanding the nuance. It's not getting to the root of what the actual issue is. It's a superficial solution, a la it's cognitive therapy. It's not esteem dynamics. And as a result, it doesn't feel quite right, and it feels like it's shortchanging, shortcutting, not understanding, and, you know, basically obtuse. And so that's probably a significant reason why it is that that is cliche, is that a lot of the advice that guys can give to a woman who is struggling with what is probably a complex esteem dynamic social psychological, you know, dilemma, that the solution to that problem is more complex, more nuanced, and different than what appears to be the case for the male who's trying to solve it. So that's probably what the deal is.
Yeah, and as evidence, we've got plenty of listeners, along with your clients, that have been asking for solutions, yeah. And we're acting on them.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that my whole career, I have seen no graph. I can remember a few times where I felt like this was true. So I can remember in the last week, I had somebody that, you know, had a sort of a relatively complicated situation, and they needed to just chatter and complain. And once I was seeing that was true, I just sat back and let it happen for about 40 minutes. And I just kind of knew. And I was learning little bits about her personality and about the players that were involved in the dilemma along the way. So it wasn't like it was totally wasted time. And so I let it chatter. And finally, she chattered herself halfway out to the point where I could finally get in edgewise. And then we went in there for the last 15, 20 minutes, and we, you know, triangulated on the course of action that was likely to be most successful. And I didn't get any resistance at all. But that's actually rare. Okay. Usually, I mean, it's rare for me to have to sit on my hands for 40 minutes and listen to the chatter. Usually, you know, at worst, I have to listen to 15 minutes of chatter, which is reasonable because the social psychological dilemmas are usually pretty complicated. And sometimes, but oftentimes it's like 6 minutes. It's really not that much. It's not that hard. And, but, you know, maybe some guys aren't patient enough or have enough confidence that they can, you know, they don't have a system that they're working. They're looking at it through their own egocentric bias and maybe just firing off a shot and say, well, then just quit. You know what I mean? Who knows? But no, I don't think that it's, Stone Age women that are just seeking compassion and that they're not seeking help or solutions. They are seeking help or solutions. I think that oftentimes what they're seeking, though, is a bit more complex and nuanced than the listener is sometimes able to provide. I think that's the big issue.
Wonderful. Well, just, all right. You know, now we have a question from a female listener who's actually a complex and nuanced question. Yeah. Dear Dr. Lyle, I am a 25-year-old female with extreme career confusion. I grew up in an immigrant household with two parents who successfully left their home countries and made it as engineers in the U.S. I grew up with the expectation that I would follow their trajectory of high-level achievement, and initially I found no issue with that. I completed a bachelor's in biological science, a master's in science, and was always en route to medical school. I enjoyed the scientific achievement. Postgraduate school, though, things started to look a little differently for me. I kind of lost academic steam. I lost interest in these notions, capitalistic notions of success, and I fell into mystical artsy land. I worked odd jobs that had absolutely nothing to do with my academic degrees and in no way resembled my level of cognitive capabilities. I dissociated from reality a bit and became intrigued with spirituality. I also became obsessed with self-improvement, internal shadow work, and the like. Recently, I feel like I woke up from a pity party slumber. I'm buckling my bootstraps and getting back on the path towards attending medical school. The problem? I'm creative, through and through. I'm highly agreeable. I'm way too high in openness for my own good. I'm extroverted and slightly neurotic. I have ADD, OCD tendencies, and err on the side of anxiety. I'm also a dancer and comedian, find myself wanting to either play or get lost in philosophy all the time. So I'm torn. On one end, I want to grow up. I want to achieve something at the high scientific level and go on to live the life that comes with that sort of stability and achievement. On the other hand, I want to live the creative life and follow the muse into the depths of my psyche. The other problem, I like nice things. I like comfort. I like luxury, fashion, let's face it, status. I find myself battling three different lives. A life of sacrifice to others through usage of my scientific aptitude, a life of being a jester of sorts and using my charm to brighten people's lives, and then a life of solitude in pursuit of philosophical truths. So what do I do? Why have I been torn in this position for the past 3 years since grad school? Am I stuck in black or white thinking? And can I have all three, or have I subconsciously ran a cost-benefit analysis and have determined that certain routes just aren't worth it?
Yeah, very good. So this is a very interesting story, and a very good place to always start on anything complicated is to say, okay, well, how does this person's situation map onto the Stone Age environment? And the answer is, it doesn't. Okay, this is a person who, you know, has, you know, parents that are successful. They are successful, and if they've quote made it as engineers in the United States, this is a bunch of very high IQ people, and what is sitting behind her is the determination and grit of very high conscientious, very intelligent, and highly successful immigrants in science and technology fields. So what do we know what is behind her? Almost certainly there's a bunch of net worth sitting inside their parents' checkbook. Okay. She's 25 years old. Isn't this a female dancer?
Yes.
Yeah. Female. Got it. Okay. So this is all good. So now let's try to figure out what the circumstances are of this young lady. Circumstances of this young lady are extremely privileged, which is not a bad thing. It's just that she's not facing the stress of the Stone Age environment. Stress of the Stone Age environment, you must be a productive member of the community every single day or you're not going to eat. You don't have any choice. Nobody even dreams that there's a choice. This is just what you do. You are also trying to find and attract mates, which means that in between times when you're trying to cook a fancy dinner, you're flirting like crazy, and then you're doing some dances and beating on a drum and, you know, making little necklaces for yourself when you have time to make things that are pretty. That's what you're doing. You're trying to be sexually attractive, and you are attempting to make sure you're well-fed. Pretty soon you're mated in no time, and then pretty soon we got kids, and then your life is, quote, full of meaning, because that's that, okay? You now a whole bunch of neural circuits turn on, and your life is completely and utterly focused on the basic survival and reproductive problems of hope you have a happy relationship, you know, hope that we get enough food and that we're okay, hope the village doesn't get sick or somebody important of our acquaintance and love gets injured, and hope my kid's okay, and we got to look out for the predators eating them. In other words, life is very, very full in a Stone Age environment. And one of the things that you're not doing is you're not sitting around contemplating philosophical anything. And the other thing that you're not doing is you're not deciding, what would I really like most to do? What would be most fulfilling for me to do? No such question ever is asked. What you do is you do the things in that village trade process that you have proclivity to do that would be the most valuable for the village, and therefore give you the best effectively trading leverage, because you're going to need that leverage because you are in a chronic state of resource deprivation. Now, and that's fine. That's all good. And so you find satisfaction. People are going to value what it is that you do, or they're not going to trade with you. So you don't get to have a failing business. There is no such thing. You will adapt quickly and copy other people who are doing things that are valuable, and you will sense the demand curves of the various things in the environment and figure out what it is that you can do and what ecological, economic niche that you can fit in that village, and you will eagerly pursue that niche so that you can get, you know, moccasins and fish, okay, in trade. So that's what a normal person has always done, is to try to figure out where can I be most useful, the greatest trade leverage, meanwhile, I'm going to be doing that for most of my life. And then I'm going to be balancing romancing and balancing, sexual displays for romancing. And then pretty soon I'm going to be having sex and having kids, and at which point, it's a whole different story and those percentages change dramatically. It's about resource allocation towards the direction of the copying of DNA. So that's going to shift around depending upon what our life circumstances are. This is a 25-year-old, highly intelligent, highly educated, well-heeled American person who knows all about birth control and therefore can have romantic processes and not have to face the consequences and of that, the terrible thing of having children and having your life have meaning. Okay. And so she could do that. And she's able to do something which I'm not snarling at all. I'm just pointing out that the consternation that she has is on the one hand understandable. In other words, human beings have had potential to do things that are creative and fascinating and interesting. They've had the capacity for 500,000 years and have not been able to realize that capacity because they've been too busy digging potatoes out of the ground and making sure their kids don't get eaten. Okay? So it is, in fact, a blessing of the modern environment that we can even ask this question. Okay? And so in answer to the question, what's actually taking place is that your mind is, in fact, running a multidimensional cost-benefit analysis. Actually, that's a redundancy. Cost-benefit analysis are always multidimensional. You always have more than one option. Okay? There's always more than one alternative for anything. Okay? So, what's my alternative to Susie? She's the only girl that'll go out with me. Answer, not Susie. No Susie at all. There's always an alternative. And the job of the mind is to calculate the relative likely value of alternative courses of action. It does this by estimating the parameters in a complicated formula, a formula that is being run in the adaptive unconscious as it tries to figure out what the most valuable course of action would be. Now, obviously, this is true. What on earth would an animal nervous system be doing other than running alternative courses of action comparisons and attempting to select the behavioral sequence that would have the greatest probability of gene survival? That is exactly what it does. Okay, a nervous system that did anything else would be selected out by evolution. So that is clearly what the nervous system is doing. And her nervous system has a very complex motivational problem indeed. And that is, oh my God, I could be a doctor. And if I was a doctor, I'd have all this esteem and then I'd have really secure money. And gee, if I have secure money and I've got all this esteem, then, I get all these fancy, nice, comfortable, luxurious things. And it opens up options for, I can stay in the nice place on Maui instead of, hitchhiking to Humboldt and having a week in a tent in Humboldt and howling at the sky like a good spiritual person. No, I'd rather go to Maui and be in the Hilton and then watch the guys do the fancy dances with beating the drums and pay $1,000 a night. That's spiritual enough. Okay. So this nervous system is attempting to, look at these things, and the problem is that she's finding is that it's very difficult to decide, and that is that they are inherently huge decisions. So if you go to medical school, you don't just decide, okay, I really would like to go to medical school because, I'd really like to have that security and that feeling of esteem of achievement, and honey, you better not go to medical school for that. You better go to medical school because you love it. You better love it. Okay, that, if you go to medical school because you want to be, an esteemed doctor and have a lot of money, welcome to a really shitty life. That is an extremely enervating career. That takes tremendous effort to do. And it takes a tremendous effort to get to the end of your residency before you're worth a nickel. So if you're going to spend 8 years, 4 years in med school and 4 years in residency, just so that you can, quote, have a good paycheck and, you know, have a life of relative luxury. You do not have a life of relative luxury. You have, you know, $300,000 worth of student loan debt. You're pregnant. And, you know, you're trying to juggle a very complicated life with incredible demands. So you better love what the hell you're doing. So no, I don't think you want to be a medical doctor. Not now. You are absolutely not ready for that decision. Now, so what are we looking at? Well, you'd like to sing and dance and howl at the moon and meditate and sell charms and paint and I don't know what. Okay, I'm just really having fun with this person because I'm not meaning to be snide. It just comes out. What am I really saying? Sexual displays make lousy careers. So all of the things that you want to do are sexual displays. These are ways to make yourself look more sexually attractive. There's no other esteem to be had in these things. That is the entire point. Okay? So I want you to think about what we would say to a young man who was white and slow and 5'9" and a half and, you know, 15 pounds overweight. And he said, God, you know, I just really love to be a professional basketball player. You know, I just feel like I would just love it so much. And it just sinks my soul when I go in a gym and I play and when I make a basket.
You're not 5'9" and a half, Dr. Lau. You're 6.
What we would say is, hey, you're not going to do that for a living, Chief. And he would say, yeah, you know, maybe I should really do something else, but, you know, I'd really like a luxury lifestyle and that would be nice. So I'm not sure what I'm going to do. Well, you're not sure what you're going to do because you're really artificially well-heeled and your parents succeeded. Your parents are a pair of ophthalmology surgeons. So that's why you're trying to figure out how you're going to, play professional basketball. No. Okay. So structural displays make lousy careers. Of course we are drawn to them. Particularly this person probably has a lot of talent. Okay. And that's why she's drawn to it, because it turns out to be a very good place to display for mates, because it turns out that she has relatively low mutation loads with respect to some of these displays. Okay. That's, she's got some creative, she can sniff that she's got some right brain cachet, got some chips in there. So that's fine that you got some chips in there. And God forbid, if there's any possible way that you could take one of these sexual displays and make a career out of it, you know, have at it. Okay. It would really be the Holy Grail. I mean, it's 1 in 1,000 people can pull that off. So, and this is what I tell people, if you're particularly talented, you know, if you're a would-be Mary Lou Retton, then my attitude is have at it. But at 30 years old, you'll probably, the handwriting will probably seep into your adaptive unconscious and you'll have enough data to explain to yourself that it's a losing proposition. Okay. Now at 25, you're probably not sure. You get enough positive feedback. It's exhilarating enough. You're not actually feeling particularly acute economic deprivation. So it is that you can kind of cruise along and, you know, howl at the moon and dance, and it's all very cool. And it's not even looking particularly irresponsible to the wider village yet, because it's not particularly irresponsible because we can afford it. You don't have three little children like you would have had in the Stone Age and no family money behind you. Okay. So this is all fine. So my attitude is, you know, howl at the moon until you start getting cognitive dissonance. The howling in the moon isn't such a good idea, which is where we are now. Okay. So this person didn't fall completely far from the tree. She fell a little ways from the tree. So there's some flaky right brain humans in that ancestry somewhere back in the old country. But she's not her parents. She's got a little more right brain hippie chick in her. And so she's flaking out a little bit, which, God forbid, there's nothing wrong with this. And there's nothing wrong with this doing this kind of indefinitely for a while, because what's slowly seeping into your nervous system is that it's, you know, sooner or later, if your parents eventually, you know, raise their eyebrows and say, we're not going to help you with your rent anymore, then we're going to have to face reality. that the rent that you're going to be able to afford by doing, you know, essentially unskilled labor is going to be not particularly comfortable. And it's going to be finally dawning on us that we're kind of not doing the best job that we could for our existence. At which point we start trying to figure out what can we do for the village that would give us a good rate of return. And then we're back to, well, I could, I've got the chops incredibly because I'm in the top 1 or 2% of IQ. I could literally go to med school potentially, but you don't want to. So don't do it. Okay. What you need is a shovel. Okay. If you're going to go into a gold mine, you know, don't go in there with a pair of chopsticks. Go in with a shovel so that you can get some ore and make some money. Now, you don't need a steam shovel. You don't need the biggest dirt digger, earth-moving equipment that there is. You're a girl, honestly, you don't need $285,000 a year. So we don't have to spend the next 10 years of your life aiming at that, particularly when you don't want to do it. So if you burn to do medicine, fine. If you don't burn to do medicine, for God's sakes, don't invest massively in pursuing that process. That would be ridiculous. Instead, let's try to make a less large decision. So I would start aiming at something that is, you know, less of an investment. I don't know what it would be. So, but we certainly want to aim at something where there's all kinds of alternatives. You can look at the world. You want to work with, Smith, Barney, and Merrill Lynch and in recruiting. You know, are you friendly and attractive and chatty, and you could do, well, maybe you, i.e., we do some kind of high ticket sales. You got high educated. If you got good social skill, you could do something along those lines. It might be fun, okay, and make a pretty good living. We can do this sort of back our way into this. We probably don't want to be a wage laborer at $15 an hour. There's nothing wrong with that, but there is something wrong with it if we could do so much better because we've been blessed by the gene gods and by this moment in history of being able to do vastly better and therefore wind up with a much better existence. So think about what else you could do. So you might become a physician assistant. That could be a tremendously shortened road relative to being a doctor. And yet, you know, it's like one-fifth of the price of being a doctor and half the money, okay? And yet it's very, very much the same kind of arena and very similar decision-making, et cetera. It's intellectually extremely similar, that or a nurse practitioner, that sort of thing. So, yeah, much better to go that direction than go all the way to an MD. That would be a way to make this a much smaller decision. That way, if you go to that school and you drop out, you know, after 3 months and you're like, no, I don't want to do this. We haven't gone to the onerous process of trying to get accepted to a medical school and then dropping out after 3 months or then never not dropping out for a year because we had to stick it out because it's such a big investment and a big process. So, you know, we could even do less than that. So, you know, I was looking once, I probably said this before in some podcast 83, that one of the things that I think is interesting to do is to look at surveys about people that are the happiest in their careers. And one time I did this, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, trying to help a client, and the client didn't have this young lady's kind of chops. They were, you know, one notch down. And we were looking at over things, and one of the highest satisfaction careers is a sonogram technician. And just turns out, you know, people really like doing it. I don't know, because a lot of times they're, you know, it's a happy thing because they're sonogramming, you know, pregnant women, and people are watching their kid kick, and they see the head, and everybody's all excited. So, you know, this winds up being, I think, it is a very high satisfaction job. It's also the kind of job that boosts somebody. At the time, it was just an AA degree. So it boosted people, you know, in 2 years, it boosted them from being, you know, a Walmart $12 an hour person to being a fully hired, you know, $48,000 to $52,000 a year salary person with full benefits. You know, working as a professional with a uniform and being cool, pretty good, an exceptionally good trade for very many people. Now, so what does the where does this leave us with the singing and the dancing and the howling at the moon and the crystals? The answer is right where it belongs, at the end of the day in our spare time. Okay? Sexual displays make lousy careers. You are welcome to try, and you are more than welcome to try if you've got family money behind you. And you are more than even that welcome to try. You must try if you burn with the idea of being an artist. Okay? If you burn with the idea of being an artist, then it's not going to bother you to starve. But when I hear, gee, but I like a luxury lifestyle, what did I just hear? Ding, ding, ding. I just heard somebody that doesn't burn to be an artist. Okay? If you burn to be an artist, the most important thing for you is to be an artist. And you don't really care that much about how rough the circumstances are. Okay, I've seen people that were very serious artists, and they can live on almost nothing. They can easily live on working at Starbucks 20 hours a week and doing their art the whole rest of the time, and they live very humbly. But they are absolutely determined to be an art, and they're not going to do it any other way. They have a rage to do their art. Good, okay? I don't think this person has a rage to do the art. They think they're a right-brainer with a lot of options and a lot of resources behind them, and they're in no rush to put their nose to the grindstone, as they shouldn't. You're discovering, you're learning, you are absolutely compiling parameter estimates with greater precision with every day that passes on trying to help you decide a career direction. I think that your career direction probably should reasonably head to a mid-level professional of some kind somewhere where you have an advantage over competitors off the street. In other words, you've got some schooling and credentialing that vaults you into a significantly higher socioeconomic status than somebody that has no such protection. But don't invest too much. You know, if you invest a couple of years of becoming an RN, for example, if you're drawn to medicine like this person is talking about being drawn, if you invest in that, you haven't invested that much. You know, it's not trivial, but you have not invested an incredible amount of time and money getting there. You can get there free at a junior college somewhere. And therefore, you can become an RN. And now as an RN, if you want to be a free spirit and travel around, be a free spirit and travel around. I got traveling RNs that make a great deal of money. They make more than $100,000 a year. Okay? So you can make plenty of money, travel around, be spiritual, and, you know, and do that. And guess what? If you decided that you hate it, we aren't stuck with it. We have an enormously valuable credential in our back pocket, and we didn't spend that much of our life getting it. So that's how I would approach generally this person, and hopefully the elements of this might be helpful for people as we try to look at, you know, a very interesting problem, you know, of a person with a lot of options and therefore not a lot of clarity.
Wonderful, Dr. Lyle. Thank you so much.
All right.
I have one follow-up question that I know you've gone over on the show before, but it's always kind of stuck out a little bit just for some clarification. Mm-hmm. So when you say the sexual displays make poor jobs,
lousy careers.
Or lousy careers, my understanding was that anything you do is a sexual display. So even if it's working hard mm-hmm. as an accountant, crunching numbers, that is a sexual display of your characteristics. Where am I going wrong here? What is it?
That's actually not true.
Okay.
Okay. No. You're a great deal of careers. Let's think about this for a second. There are two problems. There are two resource problems that the organism is designed to solve. One of them are survival problems. One of them are reproduction problems. Okay. So when you're doing a career, you could be attempting to solve a survival problem, or you could be attempting to solve a reproduction problem. If I'm trying to solve, and the kinds of problems I'm solving for others can be different. I can be helping them solve survival problems, or I can be helping them solve reproduction problems. So the thing is that I could be doing something like, for example, being a plumber, okay? When I'm being a plumber, the fact that I'm a plumber may influence my sexual status. In other words, it is being read by mates in the mating community as of a certain, you know, assignment of mating cachet for being a plumber. But I'm not doing it for that. I'm doing it to maximally trade my time and energy for maximal resources. Okay? So the resources that I get from that, I then use those as a display for mates. It's different. Okay. So I'm trying to acquire resources and show mates that I could get the resources, but I'm not trying to throw a shiny sexual display and lure mates with the display itself. Okay. Whereas if I'm LeBron James coming down the lane and soaring up for a dunk, that is exactly what I'm doing. I didn't unplug anybody's drain. I didn't cut anybody's hair. I didn't feed anybody a potato. I didn't do anything to solve any of their problems. I just showed off how sexy I was. Okay? So, and now, so of course, everyone would like their career to be a sexual display. That would be double dipping. Let me solve all the problems that I can. Let me solve my survival problems. Let me solve my resource display problems, and let me display my genes directly through what it is that I do. Okay? I actually call that double dipping. That's what it is when you're a cellist for a fancy orchestra and make $200,000 a year. Your career is a sexual display and you are making a bunch of money. Fantastic. Sexual displays make lousy careers. Successful sexual displays make incredible careers. That's why people seek them. Okay? Very difficult. Very few people make any kind of serious money and even make a decent living as a musician. Very few people make a decent living as a painter. Very few people make a decent living as a sculptor. Okay? Almost nobody makes a decent living as a dancer. Okay? Musicians, dancers, almost nobody makes a decent living as an athlete. Okay? Almost nobody makes a decent living as a model. Almost nobody makes a decent living as an actor. So almost all artistic and athletic sexual displays are terrible career paths. Right. Now, are there spectacular exceptions? Yeah, absolutely there are. It's actually interesting that that's true. One of the reasons why it is so vertical is because of the fact that we have media, that I'm not going down to the local place to watch some bunch of hack football players called the Green Bay Packers in the 1915. And that, you know, that just a bunch of people in the stands come watch. And that's where all the money was in the 50-cent tickets. Okay, those people made a little bit of extra money. That was a sexual display, and they made a little bit extra money. Apparently in this country in the early 1920s, quite a number of people made pretty decent livings at opera houses because people like to hear people sing. And there's a lot of opera singers out there that made a good living as opera singers, and opera house managers and owners made some good money packing in people on Friday and Saturday nights to listen to the opera. When the record player came in, it all ended, okay? Because people heard Caruso, and then they were like, forget it. I'm not going down and listen to Joe Blow, try to be Joe Fonchini, you know, whose grandmother was from Italy, try to pretend like he's an opera singer. When I could put on Caruso, you could forget it. And that is exactly what happened. Okay. So what happens is that the world gets extremely vertical, and a few people at the top, that's who everybody wants to see as an actor. That's who everybody wants to see as an athlete. That's what everybody wants to hear as a singer or a musician. Those people make spectacular money. Everybody else makes nothing. Okay. The supply and demand for people trying to attempt to double dip like this is huge. Everybody wants to do it. Well, if everybody wants to do it, and everybody's willing to gamble tremendous time and energy to try to get there, and there's not a nickel on the sidewalk along the way, then you can expect that these are terrible careers. Okay? But that's why I say, if you feel like you have talent and you burn for it, by all means, take your 20s and give it a shot. That would be a crime not to do that. So if I had a child or I knew of anybody that had that in them, I would tell them, for God's sakes, kid, go for broke. Absolutely. Okay. And then once you get beat up and you get your head handed to you for 5 or 6 years and you're tired of it, and you got an IQ in there saying, you know what? What the hell am I doing? That's your adaptive unconscious running the probability programs telling you that it's time to quit. That's fine. Okay. This is no tragedy. That happened to me my first, 2 weeks in basketball practice at the University of Idaho on the varsity. Like, I made the varsity team, and then what did I find? There's a kid named Donnie Newman that could just eat my lunch with his eyes shut. It's like, okay. All right. I guess I'm not going to be the next Jerry West after all. Okay. That's exactly how that happened. And I had not given up that dream, quite frankly, until that happened. Okay. And in high school, everybody I played against in high school, including some very good players, I felt like, you know what? I think I'm better than you. And I think, I think I'm at the top of this league, and we don't know it because I'm too shy and we didn't direct any plays around me. But I think I can outplay pretty much most people in this town that are my age. When I went away to the University of Idaho, obviously, it's the famous thing that the great high school pitcher, goes up to on his college team and goes in there, can't get anybody out. And he comes to the coach. He says, I don't know what's wrong. I struck out 9 out of 10 guys in high school. And the coach says, yeah, kid, the 10th guy, they're all here. That's how it is. Okay. So that's ultimately why sexual displays make lousy careers. We should try. If we burn, go ahead, go for it. Okay. And then, but keep a lazy eye looking out to the side for, what we might do when we're done. And that's fine. And then we make the sexual display, maybe a absolutely favorite hobby. And that can be great. I got plenty of people. I told them, you know what? You got the acting gene. For God's sakes, get involved in your community theater. It'd be super fun. Okay. But that's what we do after we get our nurse practitioner license. So that's how I would look at this kind of problem.
Wonderful. Yeah, and if you make more money, you could do all the sexual display you want with all the insurance behind it.
Yeah, yeah. This is all. But yeah, I think this is interesting. She's this is a person with unusual wide spectrum of options and an unusual dearth of pressure. And so as a result of that, that's leading to, an adaptive mind that is sort of chasing itself, and it's a complicated problem. So hopefully this way of thinking and analyzing it might end up providing some clarity.
Wonderful, Dr. Love. Thank you so, so much.
Okay. All right.
All right.
Maybe one more.
One more. Okay. Dear doctors, my sister is in need of bone marrow. As her only sibling, I would be ideal for this and have a 25% chance of matching. I've done some research and have learned that there are two main methods of bone marrow transplantation, but both have serious risks for the donor. For instance, a possible serious side effect is that the donor's spleen could rupture or they could have permanent bone pain. If I were in her shoes, I know my sister would do this for me. I also know that my sister is impulsive and wouldn't worry about the possible consequences. But unlike my sister, I take good care of myself. I eat a whole foods diet. I'm not on any meds, and I avoid even taking aspirin. I try to stay away from doctors, and also, unlike my sister, I'm vehemently opposed to taking the COVID vaccine. I know several people who have severe adverse reactions to it. However, my doctor says that I will likely have to take it if I want to be my sister's donor. I love my sister, and clearly, donating my bone marrow could potentially prolong her life. I could postpone a decision and simply find out if I'm a match, but if I am, I will now feel compelled to go down this road. That I'm not sure I want to go down. How do I make this decision? It's ripping my heart in two.
Yeah, very interesting. I would say that we're leaping to some conclusions here that just because you find out if you are a donor, you're in no different circumstances than you are now. Right now, you are a potential donor, and therefore you're laboring under the moral pressure and the angst of the decision. So that's not going to change if you find out that you could be a donor. On the other hand, there's a 3 out of 4 chance that we find out that we cannot be the donor, at which point we're done. Problem solved. Okay? So I don't see any other rational course of action than to find out whether you're a donor. Once you find out you're a donor, we're not going to hide behind the mythical Big Louie indefinitely while your sister gets into deeper and deeper and more desperate circumstances, and then just say, well, gee, I don't know yet, so I don't know if I can do it. It's absurd. We have to find out, okay? It's the same decision either way. We're going to have to find out. You know, we can't postpone that indefinitely. So let's go find out. And then if it turns out that you find out that you could be a donor, then we're in exactly the same set of circumstances we are now. You're not compelled to do anything. You're no more compelled then than you are now. Okay. So at that point, you know, this is an overwhelming, you know, tragic set of circumstances. And so therefore, this is difficult. It's dicey. There's one little detail after the next with respect to this that's critically important. This is a difficult decisions like this are decisions are all about the estimation of parameters. And that is precisely what your brain is designed to do as it makes decisions. If it cannot make a decision on something because the parameters are too fuzzy, it will postpone it as it seeks clarity on the parameters. This is fundamentally, it's a math problem. Your brain's job is to actually estimate the probability of alternative courses of action. Okay? If I told you there's a 1 in a million chance you would damage your spleen, then you'd say, okay, let's get out a bunch of marbles on the ground and look, see what 1 in a million actually looks like. Okay, what kind of chances am I taking every day when I get in my car and I go to the store? Okay, better than 1 in a million, we're dead. So therefore, when we look at that, we start realizing, okay, 1 in a million is reasonable. But what if it's 1 in 180? It's like, wait a minute, that's a whole different thing. So the numbers are everything. So it's not a matter of whether bad things could happen, it's how often, how likely. What variables would allow us to determine what would increase or decrease the risk? Okay, so these are critical issues. We're not even going to ask these questions until we find out you could be a donor or not. So one thing at a time. Most important question that we have on the table is, could you be a donor? If the answer is no, we foreclose all of this angst and discussion. It's over. We save ourselves an enormous amount of tail chasing. So instead, we're going to go find out. That's what I would strongly encourage you to do that. Face it. Going to have to face it. Let's go face it. Once you've got that in your hand, if you have the idea, if you get the evidence that you could be a match in your hand, for God's sakes, call me or Jen. Okay? Then you're going to get help from the outside to help you reason through this process and do the problem solving associated with really analyzing what the CB is for you. Okay? It's a complicated CB. And so I think that by the day, it's becoming less likely that you'd have to take a COVID shot, because hopefully, you know, the medical world is having a little light shined on this dog shit, and they're going to be figuring out that there's no way in hell anybody should be taking this shot. So that's one thing. You might have to move to a state that allows that information to be public. But anyway, that's a different argument. So the point is that these are hoops and issues for us to jump over later. First things first, let's find out. If you find out that you could be a donor, then we're in a space that says, okay, now we are actually in the motivational dilemma. And then we're gonna need some really careful guidance and consideration to try to figure out what is fundamentally in your best interest. Okay?
Wonderful. Dr. Lyle, thank you so much. Really appreciate you coming on and recording this again.
You bet.
We'll do the next one with Dr. Hawk with the questions that we lost last time.
Yes. And Jen can like contradict me on the chick and advice thing. Yeah, that would be good.
I think we got to like one more question just because we didn't do any small talk, you know?
Exactly. That felt right to me, Nathan. I think you got that right. All right, Nathan. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, Dr. Lyle. We'll talk to you guys next time.
Gotcha. Bye, folks.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.